live in a world in which many of us spend much of our time feeling dulled, stultified, numb. Much of what we do is compulsory or routine. It stems from the things we like least about ourselves, and often we feel weak. We wait and wait for the end of our shift, for when we can go to bed and end the day, for the weekend or the vacation, for the fix from the bottle, the sugar, or the Netflix. The hum of electronics, the drivel of advertisements and news, and sometimes even the tiresome small talk among those we call our friends, coalesce into a drone that, at times, seems to drown out any other possibility. We are told we've arrived, the end of history, the land of the free, the best of all possible worlds. But some of us feel, deeply and undeniably, that a different life is possible. We know this possibility in our flesh, for we have felt moments of ecstasy, joy, and freedom that are burnt so indelibly into our consciousness as to preclude any doubt. We call these moments, and the people who have felt them, the brilliant, because they are glorious to feel and yet dangerous to know, for they beckon us to a lifeway of passion that is not easily slaked by a world that rewards torpor. The Brilliant Podcast is an effort to share those moments and to foster them, to tell stories and explore ideas in a way that stokes our passions and reminds us that a world of ecstasy and mystery lies buried, but alive, beneath the malaise and drudge that tries daily to convince us that it is all that is, has ever been, or could be. I am your host, Bellamy, joined by co-host Aragorn, and in the background is our sound engineer, Roy Burton, although I guess he comes in the foreground sometimes.
That's true.
One day I came in and a woman who had lost a child was talking to a robot in the shape of a baby seal. It seemed to be looking in her eyes. It seemed to be following the conversation. It comforted her. And many people found this amazing.
So I'm going to talk to you about you and how you can be brilliant every single day.
Welcome to the sixth episode of The Brilliant. We just finally have started to put some of these online. Hopefully by the end of next weekend, all six will be up, or seven at that point. This is Aragorn, and today I have not had a lot of sleep, so I have a little bit of the case of the giggles, so that should amuse you. This week we're gonna follow up on our theme from last week, which is conflict, so this is going to be Conflict 2, Electric Boogaloo. And we're going to talk, we're going to try to finish the threads that we started last week specifically in talking about some of the different documents that we had hoped to talk about last week, but we got mired in collective meetings. No surprise. We're going to start out talking about the news stories. We're specifically going to talk about the identity politics piece that was shared in an episode of the Free Radical Books podcast. And we're also going to talk some more about the
podcast. That's a new podcast, Free Radical Books.
Free Radical Radio Books, I guess. We're going to talk about the Michael Schmidt situation some more, since a lot's developed in the last week. And then we're going to, again, return to our theme on conflict and basically how do anarchists do conflict. We're going to talk a lot this week about anthropological models of conflict and whether we are pro or con. So, the news.
Yeah, so it's always interesting to see what happens on A-News because I find myself always wondering what exactly is the sample, what's the sample of, or how representative, I should say, is the sample that's first of all on A-News, and then you have this kind of, what I imagine is a sub-sample of who's going to actually look at any particular article. And I was surprised by the lack of vitriol or outrage. I mean, there was a little bit of protests. Someone was saying it's too academic and that kind of thing, but no one was saying this is horrible and it justifies and rationalizes abusive behavior, racist behavior. And it makes me it gives me that little, I guess, flash of pessimism about doing anarchist media in general, because I like to think that when I do these things, I'm reaching people who disagree with me. And sometimes I see that because I get emails of people arguing with me about things I've said, but not, you know, you tend to get, or at least in my experience, more of the positive feedback than the negative. And then you think, well, am I just talking to people who already agree with me? And then therefore, is this a useless exercise? And so I wonder, with a piece like Against Identity Politics, how many of the people that the piece is talking about, including some people that are quoted very directly, are going to encounter it?
Yeah. I mean, maybe to speak more broadly, the reason why this particular piece of audio, and again, what we're talking about, the author of the original piece, their name in Anarchy, A Journal of Desire Armed, or AJODA, is Lupus Dragon Owl, and the name of the article is Against Identity Politics, Specters, Joylessness, and the Contours of Resentiment. That's a mouthful. And so this piece was read out loud by a friend of ours who told us that they had read it, and they were very excited about it being posted to this brand new anarchist audio project called Resonance Audio, I think. And then they were disappointed because Resonance Audio basically wouldn't publish it as a piece of a text that they wanted to have on their website, basically because, and I guess it was a much longer correspondence, but basically because they didn't agree with the political message. And that definitely wasn't how it was framed in the context of being posted on E-News. But it's sort of interesting to note that there is someone out there that disagrees with this article.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, Resonance Audio comes out of Olympia. And so Olympia, Washington can, you know, if someone were going to wave their hand and say, where does identity politics, like, walk the earth and, you know, leave footprints and growl and scare people, it's Olympia, Washington. And so Resonance, coming out of Olympia, did not post this this article. But then, obviously, it came to A-News and has been met with open arms and people excited that it's saying all the things that they wished had been said for, you know, millennia or whatever.
So you were saying it walks the earth there, you think more so than here?
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting.
Because
I often have heard the Bay slagged as the place where
the Bay is definitely the, you know, like, obviously if you want to look and find it, you can find it in the Bay. But because the Bay has five different anarchist scenes that all hate each other, two or three of them absolutely are mired in this sort of quote-unquote identity politics, mm-hmm. but there absolutely are two different wings that do not, that despise this sort of thing. One of those wings being the class struggle type wing, mm-hmm. and then the other wing being the quote-unquote post-left type wing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what were your reactions to the piece? You read it?
I did read it. We also read it in the reading group. You know, most of these arguments been around for a very long time.
Uh-huh.
And the main thing that was different about this article was it sort of placed it in a modern context with more recent articles and authors.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of seemed functional. I didn't feel like it was an incredibly passionate piece. I feel like, you know, when you do something that's in the 4,000 to 6,000 word range,
mm-hmm.
I feel like it's hard to stay enthusiastic and passionate in that sort of
sure.
range. And I'm probably a bit more vulnerable to a highly charismatic, passionate statement that uses, you know, two or three examples rather than a dozen examples.
Yeah.
But that's because that's sort of like, that's the magazine range. And what they did with this was they published it, you know, as sort of the core content of the current issue of the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, you know, it's I guess part of my general thing about critique at this point is I'm just not feeling critique, which doesn't mean that I don't agree with what was said in that article.
Sure.
I just don't feel as though it would be compelling to anybody who disagrees with the message.
That is my issue. I mean, I love the piece, but in this sort of academic hard-on way of, oh man, look how exhaustively researched this is, and they're bringing all these different perspectives, and they have this vast catalog of examples, but I think there's a tendency that feeds he who is already hungry, right?
Yeah.
And then you just sort of sit there going, oh, I'm so right, and I knew I was right, and now I feel even more right, because this person drew on all these things that I didn't even know about, that are still saying I'm even more right.
Yeah.
And again, I think my big grievance is, maybe I'm wrong, but I would think a lot of Ajota's readers are probably already on board.
Yeah, with that position. For sure. I mean, that's actually the argument for doing what our friend did and trying to publish it with Resonance.
For sure, yeah.
I mean, you know, so far, the new content that's come down the line from Resonance is all the insurrectionary hits of the past 3 years. Mm.
You think there's a clear kind of party line?
Well, I think that there... So I had reached out to the Resonance people, perhaps willing to try to help them out and whatever. You know, I have infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They're currently relying on WordPress's infrastructure,
right,
and archive.org's infrastructure,
right,
which, you know, I just generally think that anarchist projects should be hosted on anarchist infrastructure if it's at all possible. But what they said to me when we talked was that they were going to measure content on a metric that I wouldn't have found acceptable, and they didn't exactly make it clear what they meant by that. But now it's clear that basically they're not going to publish anything that's sort of outside of a certain party line.
Mm.
And you know, you can say that this piece is sectarian. You can say that this piece is a polemic. But I'm sorry, you can't say that this piece is totally unfair.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a hit piece.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually even attack individuals.
Right. It's not based on hearsay. It's
yeah.
Not, yeah.
And so if that's sort of their metric, that their audio project is only going to be basically for pieces that they more or less agree with, then that has no interest to me in terms of helping out their infrastructure.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, I sort of walk away from the project on that level.
Yeah, I find it a bit disappointing. I mean, of course, if someone has a specific stand that they want to put out there, you can't really fault them. But I was kind of hoping this was going to be the audio companion to the Anarchist Library, and it was just more is better, host anything, we'll host things
exactly.
We disagree with, agree with. And yeah, it seems like that's not the direction that it's going in. My one big quibble with the piece, actually, is I absolutely hate the phrase identity politics,
mm-hmm,
because it has become such a sort of morally loaded word,
yeah,
where it's almost always a pejorative, and it's become one of those easy throwaway dismissals like, oh, you fucking anarcho-leftist, or, oh, you're just a fucking identity politician. I don't think it actually describes the phenomenon very well, and it's just becomes a vehicle for lazy argumentation, I think, most of the time.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to read a little bit piece here. I was recently interviewed for, I guess it'll be the web version, the website of, I was interviewed for the website for Hostis, the Hostis Journal.
Oh.
And I'm just going to read a little piece where they basically ask me to explain as a nihilist what nihilism is. So here's my response.
I think there have been some people wanting you to do this.
Yeah, for some time. All in good faith, of course. Actually, I'm going to read the edited version, which is...
While you're pulling this up, I'm just going to say one more thing, which is, I thought Alejandro de Acosta put it really well in his piece, I think it's To Acid Words,
mm-hmm,
I think, where he talks about these words that just become these moralistic words that just indicate that you're in a certain camp or position rather than having any content. And then he talks about how the unfortunate thing is also that you can develop those counter-moral words. And I feel like identity politics has become the counter-moral word to fucked up. So if
right,
you say something's fucked up, then everyone kind of knows where you are. Okay, they're one of us, or, oh, they're not one of us. And then if you say, oh, such and such identity politics, blah, it's the same thing.
So here's the question. The smear campaign against nihilism has been going on for centuries. Far too many anarchists have believed those lies. You stand as a clear voice within the nihilist tradition. In particular, we enjoy how you historically contextualize nihilism in Boom. The big shock is that Nietzsche is not at the center, because for many, nihilism begins and ends with his name, especially if his teacher Schopenhauer is reduced to a footnote. Would you explain why you chose to begin your history with the Russian nihilists? How would you reconstruct the nihilist family tree, and what has nihilism carried into the first few decades of the new century? So, my answer. I'll start talking about nihilism by saying that I am not a nihilist. I can say that simply because I don't consider nihilism to be a body of ideas, positions, and life ways that one can be for. There is something about identity, the act of speaking to one's essential selfhood by using a term, a set of terms, or an intersection of terms that seems like the opposite of nihilism. I have been and continue to be engaged by the problems that nihilism speaks to, which I usually simplify as saying that nihilism, or nihilist-inflected anarchism, means that I find the notion of revolution to be preposterous. The idea that me and my friends have the power or the ear of others in such a way that we could radically transform society in any meaningful way is delusional. And the way that anarchists, leftists, and others tend to discuss this topic is nearly equivalent to how Christians talk about the return of Christ. This approach definition is unusual. It doesn't begin with a philosophical orientation, but perhaps something experimental. I spent a decade and a half or so taking the world-changing rhetoric of anarchism seriously, experiencing house meetings as important, stirring black beans when I worked at a collective restaurant with all the seriousness of a fanatic, fighting constantly about how tightly our values have to be seen in our daily practice to avoid hypocrisy. It took long reflection to see these activities as having value only on their own terms and not as individual steps on the long march towards something that was the actual goal of radical activity. It could be said that this nihilism has been known and named by other terms prior to the way that I framed it, and that would be true. The reason the Russians and that historical snapshot loom large to me is because of the way I see their style, lifestyle, and simple thinking is very similar to my own entry into the anarchist space. This feels much more important from a body politic than Nietzsche's observations about how the spiritual poverty of the Western philosophical tradition has created the modern age. I guess post-Vietnam, that seems obvious to so many, just as the response to it seems just as obviously to be passivity and boredom. What I'm trying to get at in the context of this other piece is that to me I basically agree with you that identity politics is an unfair name to a complicated idea that I don't entirely disagree with,
right?
Except for in the way that it plays out,
right, and that's part of my problem is what you just hit on, which is, well, do you really think that there's no grounds whatsoever to these things that people are saying? I would say there's a lot of grounds to it. It's just that in practice, I often disagree with what actions people seem to think follow from certain beliefs. And I was really hoping that the piece would unpack that definition more and maybe even say that that definition was inadequate or call it into question, but instead it actually framed it completely.
It doubled down.
Yeah, definitely doubled down.
But that's part of your goal as a critic and also as a polemicist,
mm-hmm.
is that you frame things in terms of sides,
yeah.
and you basically put everybody in their roles.
Yeah. And this term has a referent. Here's what that referent is, and this is why it sucks.
Yeah, and this is the thing I'm trying to myself work through, as like, how do we get past this? Because this method does convince, mm-hmm. and you know, definitely like I feel like a lot of the audience of what we do are people of a certain age who have utterly been convinced by this argument and this type of argumentation. And while everyone sort of agrees that we shouldn't be Manichean, we shouldn't, you know, be dualistic,
mm-hmm.
the persuasiveness of dualistic thinking continues to be effervescent, mm-hmm. in our world.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to drop some vocab on you, just to, like, and I didn't even need a thesaurus.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to maybe a certain level of just monkey behavior. Monkeys like to be in a certain monkey troop and say, this is who we are, this, and you guys suck.
And so. They're usually right. Well, are we done?
Yeah, sure.
So, this week, because of the opportunism of the Michael Schmidt story and sort of all the revelatory details that have come out, we basically have a perfect opportunity to dovetail a conversation about topical things to our topic of the week. And so the topic this week is Conflict 2, Electric Boogaloo. And obviously the Michael Schmidt case speaks to the modern way in which anarchists do conflict, which more or less is by anonymous call out, where the onus of the conflict is entirely on the quote unquote perpetrator, and the and you know all the rest of us are just trying to mediate the conflict or you know the issue between the perpetrator and I guess the victim. And in the case of Michael Schmidt, who's being accused of being a hidden white nationalist within anarchist circles, the victim is all of us.
Yeah, it's kind of strange the way that it played out in that way. There's a lot to say about this. I'm not sure where you want to go first.
Well, Where do you want?
Yeah, I guess the first and easiest observation here is to talk about how the paradigm of accusation or call-out culture is... one, both very bourgeois, and two...
What do you mean by that?
Okay. I think it implies, or I would say it requires, an understanding of human behavior that humans are independent, free-willed, rational agents who make calculated choices, mm-hmm. and that they are responsible for those choices. And therefore, the person can be called bad, because if you... have some kind of idea of relational identity or lack of individual identity, you couldn't possibly say this person's a piece of shit, deserves to be punished, fuck them, or I feel so betrayed. And so you have to, I would say, believe very much in the idea that people are truly independent. There's a kind of bourgeois liberal understanding of what people are. It's a very capitalist understanding. People deserve what they get, or they're entitled to, or they're... there are positive or negative consequences based on some essential character of this person. And I find that odd in at least certain tendencies of anarchism to think of people that way, rather than say, oh, there's something wrong with this person's social circle in general that they would do this, or this person's environment.
Well, there's plenty of people who are making those accusations, are saying that this is the canary in the coal mine of platformism, in general, because of course, Michael Schmidt is one of the co-authors of Black Flame, which is sort of this sectarian hippie site, which we talked about last week. That's pro-class struggle, pro-syndicalism, anti-every other type of anarchism that's mm-hmm. come into being in the past 150 years. Mm-hmm. So there is plenty of those accusations also. Mm-hmm. But perhaps that was the initial hit, and perhaps this last week has been much more personal. Because for those of you who've missed it, Michael, in the context of an AK Press Facebook thread, defended his behavior, and definitely the defense was pretty strange. Not the least of which is that it began with an assertion that his editor allowed him to create a Stormfront account to do his underground research of the fascists, which this sort of appeal to authority coming from an anarchist just very strange.
I was just following orders.
Exactly. The editor said I had to do it. And then there was a whole piece in it where they basically said that like 3 months of their posts on the Stormfront white power racist website was under the influence of meningitis.
It was super weird.
It was very strange.
He just makes this allusion to, I didn't even think I made these posts, but I guess I must have. But then doesn't go into any detail about what they are. So one assumes that he was maybe saying the most virulent, crazy stuff during that time.
Yeah.
And had a 3-month meningitis blackout. I can't claim to know a lot about the pathology of meningitis, but it seems strange that you would just lose 3 months of your life.
Yeah. Well, an opportune 3 months also. And then finally, people who are more in the anti-fascist space are absolutely doing their research and crossing their T's and dotting their I's and, you know, downloading the entire Stormfront website to make sure that I believe the username for Schmidt was something like Curian Blue, you know, which, you know, I mean, they dialed themselves into the frame of mind, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, anyways, and so it really this last week has become this sort of like, you know, the psychological interpretation of every sentence of the defense.
I was doing fascist method acting.
Yeah, so very fascinating. Yeah, yeah. I don't want us to go into the generalized conflict piece.
Sure, sure, sure.
But I do think that this situation, first of all, Schmidt lives in South Africa, which is far away from all the rest of us. One of the more interesting accusations I've seen in this context is the assertion that the North American, specifically U.S.-based anarchists, see themselves as the internet police of all other countries. And I kind of think that's shown itself to be a little true.
Yeah.
Like, it's a brutal assertion, and, you know, the hubris and the pathology of North Americans is being exposed here. But definitely the people who are the actors here are all in North America.
Yeah, it just reminds me of what we talked about on Free Radical Radio a while ago. This was some months ago. We talked about the idea of solidarity and how strange it has become, that it's morphed into this thing that means you pledge yourself to one side or another, or make some kind of maybe nuanced critique of events that you have never seen, of people that you don't know, of people that you probably never will know.
Right.
And it's just kind of bizarre, and it seems like the globalized mindset has absolutely worked its way into anarchism. I mean, it's been there for a long time, but I would say even more so with the modern internet globalized mindset. It's like you have to pick a side, weigh in on these things. And
yeah, I mean, again, if you're gonna oversimplify this particular situation, pretty much as a united chorus, North America is denouncing Schmidt, including with AK Press at the lead. And there have been
at least those people ostensibly know him. The other people at AK Press.
Right, yeah. Right. No, sure. Whereas two different groups have come to his defense. Anarchismo Collective has basically said that AK has dealt with this in a very shitty way,
uh-huh,
and has been very critical. And then also this organization that I don't know of, I think based in Brazil, some acronym group that wrote a letter of not necessarily support, but of, I'm not going to find it right now, but.
Yeah, I mean, the Anarchismo people are basically saying it's classic vague call out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's interesting to see, because again, you know, there's a lot of reason why North Americans consider themselves to be the owners of the internet and all internet discourse, and that's because we've been doing it for longer. Most of the infrastructure actually is based in North America. You know, we invented it, we've exported it to the world, and so, you know, when you see it from that perspective, it's like, wow, this is some behavior where if we were talking about, you know, the manufacturing of guns or germs, you know, we would feel very embarrassed to be North Americans. And then, but yet here in the context of the internet, you know, a lot of the fierce anti-fascist quote unquote organizers who do a lot of their work on the internet are all in North America.
Mm-hmm. Would you say there's more disproportionate amount of anarchist activities on the internet in North America?
I'm not sure. It's, you know, it's very hard to tell that sort of thing. I will say that in the context of anarchist news, about 4 years ago, I spent a big chunk of time in Europe. And while I was there, the Europeans in general did not hold the internet to be at the heart of their anarchist practice in any way like we do in North America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just wondering to what extent it is just that a disproportionate number of anarchists who are active on the internet are North American, or is it?
It's a big, good question.
Yeah. Or is it that there's actually a proportionally larger amount of North American anarchist activity?
My guess is that today versus 4 years ago, there's a lot more non-Americans on the internet. In other words, there has been a democratization of internet access because of the ways in which the internet allows for centralized control over what people are talking about and thinking and all the rest.
Mm.
Anyways, yeah, so that's the Schmidt case. I think we should turn this conversation into a broader conversation about conflict. So specifically, when we started this conversation last week, we got started talking about a couple pieces of writing, and, you know, in addition to talking about the Schmidt case, which has this very sort of clear cut, you know, good and evil sort of position, and perhaps returning our conversation back to Olympia and the way in which the informal social organizations out of Olympia have a particular way in which they want to talk about conflict, we can talk a little bit before we go into the broader conflict situation about another example that's a West Coast example, which is Christian Williams and his article, The Politics of Denunciation, which more or less is talking about the Schmidt situation or, you know, other situations like it.
Yeah. And I did want to touch one more thing about the sort of hypocrisy or philosophical strangeness with the accusation culture in general, besides acting as if the perpetrator, aggressor, transgressor was completely and 100% responsible for their behavior. You have this flip side where I would say most anarchists in their understanding of peoples that might be called oppressed, either for racial, economic, sexuality reasons, very much consider them not responsible for their behavior. And very much these sorts of more or less helplessly buffeted about by cultural forces. So you have, on the one hand, people who seem to very much have their agency downplayed and, oh, they're this way because of various structural oppressions. And then the aggressor, on the other hand, is totally responsible for their behavior and is a bad person for all these reasons. And we've seen a lot of instances of this just in the past few years, the way this stuff plays out with the Bay Area Book Fair, where Lawrence Jarek was called out and in some ways pushed to leave the book fair. There's the Earth First Rendezvous, where this kind of stuff has been happening, and then even the recent Seattle Book Fair, where someone was attacked ostensibly for being racist. And so Christian Williams, I think this was, what, 5 years ago, four years ago, wrote a piece. Go ahead.
Yeah, about four.
About 4 years ago. And Christian Williams, among other things, wrote Our Enemies in Blue, which is an anarchist take on policing.
Con.
He's con. He takes the con position. So about halfway through this short piece, The Politics of Denunciation, Christian says, under this theory, the sort of paradigm we're talking about, the survivor and the survivor alone has the right to make demands, while the rest of us are duty-bound to enact sanctions without question. And I should stop and say he's framing this specifically about patriarchal behavior and rape culture and that kind of thing, but I think it applies pretty equally well to other issues of call-out culture. One obvious implication is that all allegations are treated as fact, and often specific allegations are not even necessary. It may be enough to characterize someone's behavior, or even his fundamental character, as sexist, misogynist, patriarchal, silencing, triggering, unsafe, or abusive. And on the principle that bad does not allow for better or worse, all of these terms can be used more or less interchangeably. After all, the point is not really to make an accusation, which could be proved or disproved. The point is to offer a judgment. Thus, it is possible for large groups of people to dislike and even punish some maligned person without even pretending to know what it is specifically he is supposed to have done. He has been called out as a perpetrator, and nothing else matters. This approach occludes, and herein perhaps lies its appeal, the complexities of real people's lives, the multiple roles we all occupy, the tensions we all embody and live out, and the ways we all participate in upholding systems of power even as they oppress us. And then a few paragraphs later in the piece, just going to wrap this up. Our scrutiny shifts then from the abuse to the abuser, from the act to the actor. Instead of seeking out ways to heal the harm that has been done, we invest our collective energy in judging the character of the man responsible. He's obviously framing this very gendered way. Support for the survivor is equated with, and then replaced by, castigation of the perpetrator. These displays of moral outrage, I really like this part, these displays of moral outrage serve above all as pronouncements of the innocence and testaments to the virtue of those who issue them, and as such, they have a way of becoming weirdly obligatory. Since we are not asking whether some particular person committed some identifiable act, but instead whether he is fucked up, then it makes a certain kind of sense to think that anyone who, quote, coddles, defends, or supports, or even just likes him, or who merely fails to denounce him, must take a share of the blame. So there is a powerful impulse to line up on the right side, to join in the denunciation before one finds oneself called out as well.
Yeah, and of course, for those who don't know the background of this, the heart of this article was unstatedly in defense of a person who basically was involved in a relationship where the female-bodied person in the relationship perhaps instigated the initial call out on the male gendered person, but this entire article was seen as an unstated defense of the perpetrator. And so the amazing thing about this article was that at the end of the day, this article, based on some of the actions that we'll now talk about, this article became the exact case of what this article was arguing about.
Yeah.
So that basically Christian Williams, by not denouncing their friend who was being accused of being a perpetrator, by not sort of attacking that person, was basically accused of being violent. I mean, the literal chant used to shout Christian down on several occasions was, "We will not be silenced by your violence,"
mm-hmm.
or some permutation of that.
Yeah.
And that sort of just sums this whole situation up. And I recently actually stepped in it by referring to the situation sort of in a sort of oblique way. And the amount of emotion that there still is about the situation is just really jaw-dropping.
Yeah, and just to make it even more clear, Christian was stopped from speaking about something totally unrelated. He was talking about, I think...
Police violence.
Police violence and informants and things like that. And because he wrote this piece, which he certainly didn't make clear that it was about a specific event, he was deemed as being exactly what he just described, as Aragorn said.
Yeah, an amazing situation. And in, like, by touching this live wire myself a few months ago, the thing that I was really reminded about was the people who did the denouncing. I mean, of the, like, half a dozen of them who got involved in the Facebook discussion, there was no sense of shame. There was no sense of that they were implicated by this critique at all.
Mm-hmm.
That they basically at the core of this was a moral crusade, mm-hmm. and they were on the right side of it.
And no one tried to actually address the criticisms that the article has and refute them?
No, because it's absolutely not about arguments.
Right.
No, I mean, that part of this is right on. I mean, again, the challenge and I think the naivety of Christian and perhaps even us by having this conversation now is that rational argumentation has anything to do with what it is that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, like at some point we're going to be talking about the term justice, and the term justice has this sort of rational encumbrance because of how many Enlightenment thinkers use the term. But I think that in practice, almost nobody experiences justice as anything other than basically
catharsis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to get into the justice stuff, or do you have more to say about this?
Happy to do that.
So, yeah, I think getting into the justice, I always like to do the nerd thing of actually looking at the etymology of the word,
mm.
which is kind of obnoxious move a lot of the time. It annoys me when other people do, but I like doing it myself. And a part of that is that it comes from a mid-12th century word that actually does mean reward or punishment issued out by authority. So just couched within the meaning of the word is this legacy of authority, and it's hard not to see in, and the criticism has been made before, I'm not saying this is a novel point, but it's hard not to see in accusation or call-out culture the legacy, the influence of retributive justice, where someone did something wrong, they're responsible for it, and now we, acting as the sort of community body, as an authority, are going to punish this person, and that might mean name-calling them, or excluding them, or beating them up, or trying to run them out of town, or and so forth. And so it's hard not to see the colonial justice system playing itself out in this sort of less formal way.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit here.
Please.
I had a life-altering experience in my mid-20s where basically I was called out,
mm-hmm.
and it was literally in a crowded room with an audience. It was like absolutely audience spectator mm-hmm. performer sort of a situation where the performer put themselves in the body of someone who was abused by me. Like, they themselves actually what they were sort of speaking on behalf of someone else.
Okay.
But it was absolutely like what we, it was an early form of what we would call out culture now. Actually the antecedent is somewhat similar because, it was very much in the vein of a Riot Girl sort of call out.
Okay.
And the next 2 years of my life, I spent basically, like during this time period, I moved to the Bay Area and I was banned from places in the Bay Area before I even had ever gone there mm-hmm. to those places. And I was approached on the street, by people who wanted to kick my ass because of the call out. So this really changed my behavior. It really changed who I am. And so for a lot of people, and for many years, I would say to people that as horrific as this call out was and unfair and all the rest, I ultimately was glad for it because it, to put it in jargon terms, it called me out on my patriarchy in such a way that I was open to hearing. And while the accuracy perhaps was incorrect about what the call out was, the precision was right on.
The precision was right on.
Meaning that I needed to be checked. Mm-hmm. That I was more promiscuous than I should have been. That at that point in my life, my promiscuity was with people who were not my peers. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously none of this sort of respectful language was used in the context of the call out, but I heard the message, and at that point I did start dating people who were much more my peers, and in every case from that moment to today, I had basically have long conversations with people about the call out that happened now over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it really it changed my behavior, and it was this moment. It didn't make me agree with the politics of the call out, mm-hmm. nor did it endear me to many of the people who were involved in the situation. As a matter of fact, one of the people who was involved was that person who gave a shout out to me at that conference, at the NASM conference.
Oh, really?
That we were at. That was one of the people who was involved in calling me out 20 odd years ago.
Wow, that's funny.
So
that's strange.
But I bring it up because I say to a lot of people that this was actually a positive thing for me in that I was really open to it and sort of, I was the audience that was trying to hear it. That said, there was no redemption story for me. There was no way to fix the problem.
Right.
And I'm sure most people, like put me in the bad category at that time and never have had reason to take me out of that bad category since. Mm-hmm. And finally, I've said to many, many times that this was really helpful to me, assuming that other young men who were like me would have a similar sort of story where they would say that it was good for them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's the case. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, I'm not sure that's the case. Like I think that, I'm not sure if it was an individual thing or there was something about a moment where this worked for me, but you know, I've pretty much never heard another example of someone who's called out,
yeah.
who sort of recovered and stayed around at all.
Yeah. I'm glad that you told this story because I think up until now, the way we've been talking about accusation culture, call out culture has come across as very partisan, and we were just doing the sort of, this sucks for these various reasons thing. And it's good to cast the shadow of doubt on what we're saying by giving your story. I do think you could tell a very similar story about a different kind of retributive justice where maybe someone is involved in the underground economy or in some sort of criminal element, but they themselves didn't do anything too horrific. However, they were pegged and got punished for something that maybe they didn't really do, and then they were scared straight, and then they cleaned up their act. And you know, I don't think we would have the same kind of sympathy for that kind of story as you have for your own. You see what I mean? I mean, ultimately, you're saying there was a kind of scared straight element.
That's an interpretation.
You brought a certain amount of reflectivity to bear on it, but from the outside, the perspective is you got called out, you worked on your shit, and... Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily say I worked on my shit. Mm-hmm. In other words, part of the working on your shit thing?
I'm saying that's what the story might sound like to a third party that's outside.
Sure, that's fine. That's why we're talking about it more. Mm. The working on your shit usually means that you agree with the criticizers.
Sure.
And I ultimately don't agree with the criticizers on any of the points that they sort of made, or any of the points insofar as they understood what it was that they were doing. But the project that the instigators are interested in, there's something there. There's something there that's to respect, and there's something there that is something about the gap between using these big words that have all this loaded language like patriarchy or, mm-hmm. you know, oppression. There's something about where that terminology ends and where the life experience of people who are the patriarchs, in this case, where their experiences are. Because very few people, myself included, saw themselves as participants in a system called patriarchy. Mm-hmm. You know, I was raised by a single mother.
Right.
I absolutely experienced her sex life in Technicolor. I didn't start dating actively until a couple years later than most of my peers. But then I found myself, like many other adorable tweens, you know, getting as much nookie as I could, as were all my peers. You know, the winters are long in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And then basically,
I don't usually associate tweens with nookie.
I was post tween anyways. But I'm not sure what the pithy term teenagers.
Yeah.
There we go, teenagers.
Yeah.
But the point being that the moment that I should have woken up and seen the context of where my sex life lived, you know, happened in my mid-20s. And
right.
For many people, it never happens. For some people, it happens when they're younger. Today, perhaps it's younger because of the way in which these words are bandied around in different ways than they were, you know, in the mid-80s when I was a teenager. But the point is that sort of like where my activity lived in, which was this, you know, semi-political space, and where this terminology lives in, which perhaps is everywhere, or perhaps it's just in the places where people use the jargon all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like figuring out all the nuances of those gaps, that's what I got out of being called out, was basically I could no longer casually continue how I was before. I was already realizing that in sort of like realizing, wow, I'm just getting older compared to everyone around me. Mm-hmm. What am I, like, how much longer can I do this? Like, I need, and at the time I was trying to move to the big city. At the time I was thinking I was going to move to DC. It ended up that I moved to San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and that's where I belonged, because basically, at least in the mid-90s, it wasn't possible for you to, you know, to grow old in the Midwest surrounded by people who are 10 years younger than you.
Right. Right. And just to be clear, for those who don't know, you would call this a hardcore punk scene?
I mean,
because you called it a semi-political space, but I don't know if ever.
I mean, Riot Girl is a semi-political space, you know, in the early to mid-90s,
mm-hmm.
in that obviously it was people trying to find politics that today
right.
is a lot more refined.
Right.
But at that time, still, you know, still most of the people came to the room because Bikini Kill was playing, not because
right.
of the politics. And mostly at this moment, while there was still, yeah. Yeah, saying it was the punk scene is fine.
Yeah. And so I wanted to move in our last section here to talk about a few alternatives, you could say, or anarchist, more or less anarchist, I'd say less in some cases, takes on justice that aren't in this, what I would say, retributive justice paradigm of call-out culture.
Well, and this is probably best exemplified by Bob Black's piece, Wild Justice, where, you know, and again, in reference to last week, we'll also talk a little bit about the Broken Teapot zine, and then perhaps a little bit about Bashback. But obviously there's a lot to say in terms of the Bob piece.
Sure. So Bob's thesis, for those who don't know, this is an essay. I'm not sure what year it's from, but
not that long ago.
Okay. And it's in his collected essays, defacing the currency. And so Bob's basically, he's drawing heavily on another piece, but his thesis is basically crime. A lot of crime can be understood as self-help, as people trying to personally seek justice and as a resolution of conflict. And he argues that even though we have this idea maybe of the state tries to impose order and crime is disorder, he's arguing that actually a lot of crime is a way to discharge social tensions and preserve social order. And crime tends to, this kind of crime, tends to appear roughly inversely to how much police presence and state enforced social order and court activity there is.
And what, so, what do you think of his? What do you think his project is? Is it just to redeem himself?
Well, he talks about how he's very much averse to the idea that every criminal is sort of an anarchist, but they don't know it. But that nonetheless, we can understand this kind of self-help that doesn't appeal to authority as a kind of anarchist impulse, because it's this way of trying to settle our conflicts ourselves. And one of the more significant lines for me that I read when I was just new to these ideas was from Derek Jensen. I don't know that if he was drawing on someone in particular when he said this, or if this was his take on things, but he said something like, we are so, I think he probably said domesticated or something like that, that we have lost the ability or the inclination to solve our social conflicts ourselves. And the law and the state very much acts as this kind of prosthetic that replaces a capacity that you would hope a reasonable human being would have. And you know, I was new to these ideas at that time, but I thought, oh, that's really fucking good. You know, how much of weird avoidance and mediation is there that we have to sue someone or, you know, we have to call the police? And I grew up in a home with domestic violence and with a brother who was regularly involved in petty crime. And so it was very common for me to have the police at my house when I was a kid. And there was always this sense of like, oh yeah, things got out of hand, so the police are here, like rather than us being able to redress these issues ourselves. And so I think there's something there. Do you have a take on it?
Well, I guess I've sort of lost the sense of all of this. Because I'm just not sure any of this terminology or any of these words mean much at all to me. I guess the way I'd put that is that I think that the traditional, the old school anarchists, the Colin Wards, the Emma Goldmans, that I left my reading of those people just sort of abandoning terminology like justice and all the rest.
Yeah, I did want to get to that. You're anticipating me, but go ahead.
Yeah, But what it means to me today, like I'm very involved in conflicts. I mean, for me, why this topic continues to be really fulfilling is because, like, I have chosen conflict as a way of life, but I haven't chosen revenge. Mm-hmm. I haven't chosen justice. Mm-hmm. And so I guess for me, the best kind of conflicts keep on going. Mm-hmm. And perhaps there's some rules or maybe they're informal. But the idea that, you know, for instance, I've been at a type of war with what I see as quote unquote red or class struggle anarchism for 20 years, mm-hmm. that to me feels like the right kind of conflict. It's a conflict about ideas. It doesn't have to, you know, it doesn't involve popping tires or, you know, like fart balloons or something, like whoopee cushions. There we go.
I was trying to figure out what a fart balloon was. I was imagining filling a balloon with
fart.
Yeah. Like, what do you do? Open it up in someone's house?
And so there's a thing going on for me here where I don't actually get what Bob's talking about, because ultimately this piece reminds me of sort of where Bob's late trajectory has been, which is to become more and more lawyerly. Mm. So this piece, the democracy piece, and his extensive piece that was the second half of his of the new Instead of Workbook are basically these very long-winded, rational, lawyerly type arguments.
Mm-hmm. Exhaustively cited.
Exhaustive, but not exhaustive in terms of talking about the motivation. So for instance, I don't get why revenge is such a motivation for Bob, and I didn't get it out of this article, even though I see this article as absolutely an apologetic for basically the last 30 years of his behavior.
Sure. I mean, I think in some ways he's sort of examining a phenomenon more than taking a position, and then at the end he sort of tacks on this position of, therefore, why not seek revenge? Why not have a sense of honor? And I think that's all fine for people who experience that. What I was going to come around to, and we're sort of jumping ahead because I was going to talk about the restorative and transformative justice, but I actually don't know if we have time.
We have another 10 minutes or so.
Okay. I would just say I'm not someone who is interested in justice. I do see it as a very weird sort of abstraction, because I think it implies, no matter what way you cut it, that somehow things can be uneven or not good, and that it has to somehow exist in the universe in some way, and then that balance can be righted. And I just don't think of human relations in those terms at all. I think if you get a certain satisfaction out of doing something, go for it. But framing it in terms of justice, to me, immediately moralizes it. It turns it into some kind of cosmological claim. And if there is justice, there has to be some sort of judge, whether that's an institution or a person or an abstract idea.
Well, I think eventually it would be computers.
Yeah, sure. And I don't feel the need to invoke any of those things. It seems very much like an appeal to the good or.
Yeah, but again, I want to go back to the meaningful argument about call-out culture, which is to say that there's something here that has to be ultra-rational. And both Bob and us, in responding to Bob, are still thinking about it in terms of irrational terms. Mm-hmm. And so, to put it a different way, what is it that works about revenge? Just to
emotional release. Yeah.
Well, I would say, I mean, obviously a lot of people will really want the details of this, but I'll try to be as a little cagey, but not entirely cagey about this. Morgan, in coming into the long haul and attacking Bob, actually absolutely succeeded at their goal. Mm-hmm. Bob will never do another public event in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. I also think this person was motivated by that kind of cosmological sense of what is good.
Right. No, exactly. But yeah. But the point being that if your goal is to not have snitches and anarchist spaces,
right,
actually Bob is helped Morgan out to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating, because in general, you know, people who have machinations and are working along lines like justice tend to never get the goal that they desire. They intend mm-hmm. they instead get an unforeseen consequence mm-hmm. that may or may not be similar to the goal that they desired originally. And that's actually, to me, a fascinating aspect of what Bob is implying in his piece, and sort of his, you know, like I don't know, there's something in here that I think is really rich, which is that the only thing you really can talk that you can guarantee when you engage in revenge is unforeseen consequences. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit about this in the context of transformative justice.
Sure.
The fuck that is.
Right. So I called on an article by Scott Akagawa of the Partnership for Safety and Justice. I don't know anything about this person or this institution other than that it seems like a sort of left liberal nonprofit, from what I could tell. And this person was trying to distinguish restorative justice from retributive justice, and then in turn distinguish transformative from restorative. So, yeah, so there's a whole taxonomy of justice here. But to me, it all sounds the same, which is what I'm going to get to at the end. So they stress that restorative is specifically anti-vengeance, mm-hmm. not focused on getting revenge on the perpetrator, because this just recapitulates to them the whole problem. And you try to shift the focus away from the perpetrator onto the survivor. And the idea is to have the victim and perpetrator interact. The perpetrator tries to make amends. You reintegrate both people into the community. The idea is everyone gets to tell their story, the community participates, and the idea basically is to re-knit social bonds that might have been fragmented or otherwise harmed from the act. So I would still say it participates in this idea of, you know, wrongs can be righted, which I don't see that.
Yeah, in a similar vein, I'd made the argument in some conversation that you know, the best method to deal with sort of rape culture is to teach women self-defense and to establish clear boundaries. And the response to me, of course, at that time was to say that's putting the onus mm-hmm. of the work on the quote unquote victims, and that it's not putting enough of the onus on the potential perpetrators. Now, obviously, we live in an era where the perpetrators in general are taught at a young age about what perpetration is and how to, and that no means no and all the rest. But sort of where you're going does bring us into that sort of direction, which is that the thing that we are capable of doing is healing and getting past rather than resolving mm-hmm. and deepening ties or something like mm-hmm. that.
And then the transformative definition, according to this person, is very fucking similar, except that it frames it in what might be called more of a radical critique by saying, you know, we can't ultimately restore the past. We have to move forward, and we need to understand that the reason most or all of these things happen is because of structural oppression. Uh-huh. So it
takes the agency right out.
Yeah, it takes the agency right out. What it comes down to is I'm not super excited about anarchists framing things in terms of justice, talking about justice. I think we should be about something else. I feel like I'm about something else. Justice ultimately comes from an idea of authority, whether it's embodied or abstract.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, and I feel like we could go for weeks more in conflict, but I think that we've sort of sketched an introduction to the conversations, mm-hmm. and I think we actually do need some outside feedback, maybe some more examples.
Yeah.
So I think that we should definitely stop for this week and then think a little bit about like changing the theme and maybe coming back to conflict another time with a bit more of a focus.
Yeah, so Aragorn mentioned something in passing. I just want to emphasize it, which is this is, as we've been framing it, a podcast about stories, and so we would be very interested in hearing other people's stories about these topics, about other topics, very open to suggestion for topics, and so forth. And I guess that's all.
We just want to end this episode of the Brilliant with some logistical stuff that we haven't sort of taken care of up till now. And all this information is on the website, which is at thebrilliant.org. And you can email us at thebrilliant@thebrilliant.org. And I'm Aragorn. This is Bellamy. Our sound engineer is Roy Burton. And what else is logistical stuff that we haven't sort of
set email?
Email is thebrilliant@thebrilliant.org. Probably all permutations will work eventually, like brilliant@thebrilliant will work, et cetera, et cetera. Perhaps even we'll have a Bellamy at the Brilliant, an Aragorn at the Brilliant.
Yeah. Feel very included now. Social bonds are being restored. I think
Indeed.
That's all.
Okay, great. See you next week.